Welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 29 for December 15th, 2009. My name is Ben Snakehoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rabia
and David O'Brien.
We've got three stories for you guys, as usual. The first story that we're going to cover is the TechCrunch v. Fusion Garage imbroglio over the Crunchpad and who owns it. The second story that we're going to cover is Judge Gertner recently released an extra opinion in the Tenenbaum file sharing case, and we're going to go over what she said in that opinion and what it's going to mean for fair use. And lastly, we're going to talk about some recent developments in privacy law, including the new Facebook privacy policy changes. So without further ado, let's just dive into the first story, TechCrunch, Crunchpad, and Fusion Garage. For those of you who aren't following this very closely, essentially what happened is TechCrunch, the company that's run by Michael Arrington, the noted blogger, was working on developing what they were calling a Crunchpad, which is a touchscreen internet tablet. They eventually partnered with a company called Fusion Garage, based out of Singapore, and they kept on saying that they were, you know, days away, weeks away from having a launch, up until late November, when Michael Arrington made a post on the TechCrunch blog, which basically said that the wheels have totally come off this thing. Essentially, what had happened is they kept on encountering delays in getting the hardware out, and eventually the head of Fusion Garage, the company that was developing this, developing the hardware and some of the software, said, well, we're going to move forward without TechCrunch because we don't think you guys are pulling your own weight. And they then had a launch of the product under a new name, the Juju, J-O-O-J-O-O. And since then, TechCrunch has filed suit in California court trying to get, among other things, the Juju from trying to prevent them from selling the device. So, who can help me out here? What are the causes of action that are alleged in this? Or at least, what's one of the causes of action that they're talking about here?
Well, one of the largest ones is the breach of fiduciary duty, which stems out of California laws, if I remember correctly. And they are TechCrunch is essentially alleging here is that a partnership was formed when these two entities decided to go forward and make the device. And once you do that, and you don't necessarily need to have any documents that are filed with the state, by the way, you get sort of default statutory partnership formation when you have at least two people that go together for a common interest in fulfilling some sort of idea for profit. And even though it looks like there wasn't any actual documents that were filed with the state or in either country, as a matter of fact, what TechCrunch is saying here is that there was a partnership that was formed, and when you form one of those partnerships, you owe certain levels of duty to your other partners that are involved in the partnership itself. So at the point where the Fusion Garage decided to go off and go its own way, at that point you essentially had a breach of the fiduciary duties, and without them indicating that they were considering doing this or completely cutting them out. Also, there might be some questions as to the ownership of the IP at that point as well. That sort of seems to form the crux of the claim there.
Right, and an interesting part about this is right when this broke out, one of the first responses that came from Fusion Garage was, well, you know, you can't do anything to us because you guys don't have a contract. And from what I can tell from what was filed in court, there was no contract. And in support of that, of the five causes of action that were set out in the complaint, none of them is breach of contract. And there seems to have been no written document exchange between the two. Between the two companies about, you know, what kind of profit sharing there was going to be, who's going to own the various intellectual property. There doesn't seem to be any of that.
Just as a quick aside here, this is a great pointer to anyone that's ever thinking about going into business for doing anything. This is why contracts are so necessary. And I know that it's such a pain to put them together and sit down and actually hash out all the terms, but, you know, those end up being the default mechanism for when you have a dispute like this, how you're going to resolve it, who's going to own what, and you can sometimes even preclude lawsuits if you have a contract in place as long as the parties are willing to work together. That was obviously not the case here, though.
Right, and even then, when Fusion Garage first said, you know, there's no written contract, you know, there's no breach of contract, Michael Arrington's crazy, even that, no, even if there wasn't a written contract, that wouldn't have precluded a breach of contract cause of action because, you know, there are oral contracts. But in the end, TechCrunch didn't go that way. They went for this breach of fiduciary duty. And to go back to what partnerships for a second, Dave was saying that, you know, a partnership, you don't need any sort of legal documents to form a partnership. Indeed, you could form a partnership by saying to your, you know, next door neighbor, hey, do you want to open a, you know, lemonade stand this week? Yeah, sure. That's a partnership. It's two or more people who join forces to, you know, work together.
The actual legal standard might go a step further, and I think you have to have something that goes in the next step of actually going ahead to form that lemonade stand before you really get the legal formation of a partnership, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that sounds right, but again, you don't need any... It's not a very formal way of setting up an organization. It's not like a corporation where you need to file papers or anything like that. It can be very informal. Now, one of the other causes of action that was alleged in this was essentially false advertising. Now, the Lanham Act, which is the same act that gives us the trademark laws, it's a federal law. It says that, you know, false or misleading advertising is against this act, and if you're affected by false or misleading advertising, you can sue and recover some sort of damages. A good example of a suit that fell under this was... last month, AT&T sued Verizon because Verizon was running a series of ads that AT&T was alleging misrepresented AT&T's coverage. So these were maps, and they showed the 3G coverage of Verizon and the 3G coverage of AT&T. And Verizon has much more 3G coverage than AT&T does. AT&T said, the way these maps are represented, it looks like, you know, Verizon is showing their entire coverage map, and they're showing that against AT&T's entire coverage map, which, you know, showed that it covered very little of the United States. That suit ended up, they came to an agreement, but that's the same gist here. In this case, TechCrunch is saying that the way that Fusion Garage is advertising the Juju, the tablet, I can't believe they named the tablet that, as a side note. The way they're advertising this, it's false or misleading, and it's hurting TechCrunch as a company. Now, I've read the complaint, and there are 60-some-odd allegations before they get to this cause of action, and I'm having trouble seeing it. They're basically saying that because the Juju is advertised as having, you know, features that were co-developed by TechCrunch and Fusion Garage, and because Fusion Garage is saying that they developed them entirely by themselves, that's false or misleading advertising, and I just don't see how that fits into what you typically prosecute under this.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm not sure what... It's pretty sparse in what they actually put in the complaint in terms of false advertising. It's very conclusionary. They don't say what they're basing it on. They just say that it happened, and it's like, well, what happened? Like,
yeah, right. it makes me wonder... David.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it says here in the complaint that the Juju product was intentionally and materially misrepresented in its nature and its characteristics and the quality of the goods that were going to be produced and the commercial activities of both Fusion Garage and TechCrunch, and they continue to do that as well. Terribly vague, as you're right, but at least they seem to indicate that something is being misrepresented in terms of the advertising for the device.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if this even rises to a level where you can sustain an action for it. Would this be dismissed because they're not, you know, stating clearly enough what it is they're saying is false or misleading?
It could be. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in terms of the procedural effects, I think of some of these claims, it's usually a pretty low standard in terms of what you have to plead, but you still have to make out that there is in fact a cause of action. I would have liked to see something a little bit more specific that indicated exactly what was being intentionally and materially misrepresented. And it could be the case that what TechCrunch is trying to get at here is that they were involved in this up to a certain point, and then they were kicked out of the project, and they lost control over all of those types of things, including the nature and characteristic and the quality of the goods that would be produced. And so at that point, they're trying to say that you can no longer include the TechCrunch name at all with this because we have no control over those things. And, you know, it could be the case that this device comes out, it's awful, and now it's tarnishing the the inherent goodwill that's within the name TechCrunch.
Right, but if you go to the Juju page, there's absolutely nothing about TechCrunch in it.
Another great point is the way that this seemed to come to light, and I didn't know if there was any other ways that this was actually released to the public, was through TechCrunch. And Mike Arrington made a post on his on the blog, actually, and he was the one that sort of laid this all out, and he was saying, this is the reason that the Crunchpad is no longer going to be produced. So I don't think anyone would have really known that it was no longer being co-produced by TechCrunch.
Yeah, I don't see exactly. I think the way they're trying to substantiate their false advertising claims is that they're saying that, well, the Juju is really the Crunchpad, and anything they say about the Juju, they're saying about the Crunchpad, because the Juju is the Crunchpad. And obviously the other side is going to disagree. They're saying that this is a separate device, that it's not the Crunchpad. The Crunchpad is gone. This is what we've been building. So,
yeah, amusingly,
it's kind of shaky feeling. So,
yeah, one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is that Michael Arrington is a lawyer. And it constantly amazes me that lawyers can get themselves involved into sticky situations like this, and that there wasn't anything screaming in the back of Michael Arrington's head that he may have... You know, would have been a good idea to have a contract.
No contract,
here.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to his credit, he was a lawyer. I don't believe that he practices anymore, and I certainly am not aware if he is maintaining his bar membership in California. But very smart guy, graduated from Stanford Law School, and here he finds himself in this situation. I'm sort of baffled by the fact that there was not a contract in place to produce a hardware device like this.
Yeah, considering how many contracts there would have had to be between, you know, people who are providing goods, and Michael Arrington constantly represented that he has, you know, drummed up a lot of what are usually called angel investors, a lot of venture capital. You know, there must have been contracts here between lots of other parties. How there wasn't a contract between TechCrunch and Fusion Garage just blows my mind.
Yeah, I agree. This is... it's a mistake, I think, not to have a contract in place. I mean, when you're managing anything that has to do with the production of hardware and the eventual marketing of it, you know, I could envision at least 5 separate contracts that you might need right there. Notwithstanding also having the partnership dots, or at least a joint venture agreement between TechCrunch and Fusion Garage, you want to have the relationship sort of boiled down into details of who's doing what, when things are expected, and who's bearing certain costs on which side and stuff. You know, it's probably much easier to conduct business on like an arm's length level, where you're negotiating with somebody over the phone and you guys are good buddies or whatever, and you agree to do things because he's a good guy and you're a good guy. But sometimes these things happen and someone wants to take something in a drastically different route, and it kind of leaves other people out to dry. That could be the case of why we see sort of these not very specific, or at least in the case of the false advertising, and not very specific claim in the lawsuit.
Yep. Any concluding thoughts before we move on to the next story, Dominic?
I'm still kind of shocked that they didn't put anything on paper, put ink to paper, in terms of, and they went this far, and then I'm not surprised, honestly, to see it fall apart, because there was nothing binding them legally.
Also, the third cause of action I don't think we covered, which was the misappropriation of business ideas. Did you mention that, Ben?
No, we didn't get to that one.
I'm not very familiar with this law, so I really can't speak about it in depth, because I think it's a California-specific law, but it is another, it sounds like just the way that the claim is phrased in the title of the action, a misappropriation of a business idea, is essentially you took my idea and you've used it and you're going to commercialize it, basically. That would be another way that TechCrunch is trying to get at the company for sort of absconding with its idea.
Right. Interestingly, none of the paragraphs in the complaint of that section lay out a statutory basis for it, so that means that it was either a poorly drafted complaint or it's a common law claim.
I would suspect it's a common law claim, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, common law, by the way, for the readers, is a law that's made by judges as opposed to law that's made by the legislature. It's very common in the United States. These aren't activist judges who are making law. It's a long legal tradition that dates back from very early courts in England, where we get our legal system from. The complaint, it lists a whole lot of, you know, preliminary allegations, and then it says, you know, first cause of action, second cause of action. at least in the copy that I have, it will say, you know, TechCrunch incorporates by reference and realleges in paragraphs 1 through underscore underscore above. So I hope they didn't file this version of it, but the one that they posted online, they forgot to fill in where their factual allegations ended on all of these, which it's not dispositive of anything. They'll get to file an amended complaint if they pick it up and if they actually filed this one instead of the other one, instead of a fixed one, but it's
so out of all the causes, out of all the causes of action, I want to say that the misappropriation of business idea is probably the most specific out of them, and it lays out the similarities basically between the this new device and what the Crunchpad was supposed to be.
It does, but I can't help but wonder if, again, I'm not particularly familiar with the California laws in this case, but I can't help but wonder if it just would meld into the breach of fiduciary duty. If there's this pre-existing business relationship, you gotta wonder, if there's a pre-existing business relationship and no contracts, you gotta wonder how easy it would be to prove that these ideas were misappropriated.
Right, well, you have that, but you might also say along those lines that just because there was a partnership in place to begin with, and this was co-developed, then you have like a 50-50 ownership of the idea itself. And so this might turn into a battle of who owns what. And along the same lines, we didn't see an intellectual property claim here either.
I mean, misappropriation of a business idea is essentially an intellectual property claim. It's just not a, it's not copyright, it's not trademark, it's not patent.
It's a very broad claim. It approximates a very broad intellectual property claim to me, at least.
Right. It seems like it's almost a trade secret, but it's a weird California version of it. So I already asked this once, but Dominic, any last thoughts before we move on to the next story?
Nope. All set.
David?
Yeah, it looks like they have some good claims in here in addition to some of the ones that aren't very specific, so I'll be interested to see where it goes.
Right. So the next story that we have is the Sony v. Tenenbaum case. This was a case that was litigated back in late July. I think it went into the first day of August, the court case. And this was Joel Tenenbaum, a student in the Boston area, was being tried for file sharing. Being tried for sharing some music files. There, he admitted guilt on the stand. He admitted that he shared these files. So at the trial, the case is essentially boiled down to how much money he owed. There were, however, a few lingering things after the trial that were just resolved by the judge. Specifically, the recording industry asked that he destroy all of the music files that he illegally downloaded, and the recording industry also asked that Joel Tenenbaum be stopped from advocating file sharing online as a part of this judgment. Now, Judge Gertner, who heard the case, issued rulings on most of these motions. Can one of you two give us a breakdown of what she said, in short?
Well, she agreed with the RIAA and has ordered Joel Tenenbaum to destroy all copies of music that were at issue in the case.
Right. However, she did not agree with the RIAA on the injunction part and said that this court is not going to say that he can't advocate file sharing if he wants to. That, you know, it's not the word advocating is what she had a problem with, and she basically said, you know,
First Amendment.
Yeah, the First Amendment is going to preclude me from saying that he can't advocate file sharing when advocating. It wasn't definite enough was her problem. She didn't know that it would be clear what would and what wouldn't be considered advocacy. And as a result, it wasn't very narrowly tailored to...
She did grant an injunction similar to their original request, which didn't have anything involved with the promoting or advertising part. In other words, not no speech component. So,
can you explain that a little more?
So in their original complaint, they didn't have the bit about restricting him from promoting and advertising the internet or online media distribution systems to infringe copy. In other words, the original thing was basically he shouldn't share, destroy all his files, he's not allowed to infringe anything anymore, and destroy everything, and that was it for the original complaint. What they added in the revised version of the complaint, or the amended version, they wanted to bar him from promoting or advertising, and as you said, the judge said that probably encroaches upon the First Amendment, so she didn't want to use the court's discretion in order to enact that. Instead, she just said, all right, well, he's not going to be able to infringe or and he has to destroy all his infringed content.
Right. And unless anybody has any more comments on these seem pretty straightforward. The substantially more interesting part of all of the orders that she released, and these were released on the 7th, and if you go to the post on the blog, you'll see a link to an article that has all of these in it. It was very interesting. She gave a written motion explaining why she denied the fair use defense in this case, and that was going to be the heart of the case. But unfortunately, Judge Gertner took that away from the defendants right before, you know, basically on the eve of the trial. She said, you know, you haven't come forth with sufficient facts that would allow me to consider this fair use defense, and as such, we're just going to take it away. The things, however, that she laid out as to what would constitute fair use blew my socks off. Do you guys just want me to go over those, or would you like
Please.
To comment on them? Among the Cover things it. That... Sorry, David?
I was just going to say, tell us all about your socks, but... lost the moment, sorry.
Yeah, that's what I get for over-talking. Yeah. Among the things that she suggested would be fair use would be... if I had purchased a copy of it legally, like a CD of this music, and I decide to go online to download a copy to make a backup as opposed to just putting the CD in my drive and ripping it. Among the things that she said would constitute fair use, or at least create a triable issue as to fair use, was, and this is the one that really blew me away, sampling music, downloading it, seeing if you like it before you buy it. And the mere fact that a judge would even go that far to say, you know, this may have been a triable issue, you know, if you said that that's what he was doing, I would let you go forward and, you know, put forth evidence that that's a fair use. And that was just stunning. I mean, and this is just a district judge. It's not binding on anyone. It doesn't have any real legal effect, but that was just a very surprising thing to see in an opinion.
I mean, the inherent problem is the fact that you have rampant copies running around and that you are essentially violating the right to reproduction there to begin with in order to go ahead and do that sampling. And if you're downloading the entire song and just sampling it before you go out and buy it, I mean, that just seems to have a ton of problems with it to me. A lot of people, though, have debated this, including notable legal scholars, and some people out there do believe that this is something that should or could fall with under the guise of fair use. I'm not entirely convinced. I think that that sort of takes an extreme approach to it. I'm more apt to believe if you stream something for 30 seconds, that might be something you could argue a little bit better to say that constitutes fair use in terms of sampling issues. But if you're downloading the entire track online, sort of illicitly through BitTorrent or something, it's totally different to me.
I seem to recall back in the early days of the internet, people used to put that up, like early Ware sites, for example, would say, "We're not really a Ware site; we're a preview site. Just we're not liable. You're only supposed to download the program and then install it and then delete it after you've decided whether you want to purchase it or not."
Yeah. Alternatively, there was the personal backup site where you're allowed to upload these to the servers as an own personal backup, so you can download them later if.
But I mean, clearly, the personal backup thing is actually in the statute, if I remember correctly. But there is this trial thing this sort of just trying it out thing in the statute? I don't think so. Like, but why would the judge reference it, and why did those sites back then choose to use it? So
I don't think it's definitely not in the statute. There's nothing in
right.
the statute that says you can
I guess it's case law.
Copyright for a short period of time, you know, just to see if you know, like the thing.
Right.
And I'm not familiar
shoplifting,
with any cases.
I was just trying out the item. I just wanted to take it. I wasn't going to steal it. I just
For the record, we at least I personally do not like the idea of equating file sharing with shoplifting.
Yes.
I think it was just a poor choice of analogy on the part of Dominic.
Sure. Yes, yes. Yes.
Anyway, I think...
There are different acts.
Yeah. I don't know personally of any cases that support that idea. I think it is arguably fair use. I was just very surprised to see a judge say that out loud in an opinion. Especially,
it just takes an extreme approach, right?
I don't know how extreme it is. It's the kind of thing where I was just surprised to see somebody say it out loud. I think it's a fairly reasonable position to take that, you know, you should be able to try something before you buy it. And you know, your choices, your current choice in the market for trying before you, well, I guess now you have more choices than you used to do. I could try to stream something from Pandora or one of the other, you know, Last FM, or I can listen to the 30-second preview on iTunes, but that really doesn't give me a flavor of the entire song. That gives me a select 30-second chunk of the song, and Pandora is more, but Pandora doesn't even have every song on it. There are a lot of songs that Pandora and Live FM don't have, and you can't stream.
Last FM, but yeah. And
what did I say?
Live FM.
Last FM, yes. Sorry.
Yeah. But yeah. So, but at the same time, you can sort of see the analogous, like, oh, I heard the entire song on the radio, but the radio, you don't pay for anything, but the radio people did, so.
Right. You know, somebody gets paid when you play it on radio, and somebody gets paid when you stream it on Pandora.
Pandora, right.
Nobody gets paid. Currently, nobody gets paid when you listen to the 30-second previews on iTunes or Amazon, but.
So apart from that, what else blew your socks off, Ben?
That was mainly the thing that blew my socks off. I was very, very surprised to see that in it. I was just, I did not expect it.
But again, we're talking about procedurally in terms of how these things get litigated. She's saying it's a tribal issue. She's not necessarily saying how that might turn out in the end based on the facts of the case. But maybe she's saying she'd be willing to entertain the arguments before the court and just hear it out.
Right, that's a good point. You know, this
it's a big distinction, you know, in different to saying like this is totally fine if you're thinking about downloading and sampling it this way. That's not what she said. She was saying, well, if you want to argue this in front of me, I'm willing to hear you out.
Right, and essentially because you guys didn't argue this, we weren't, because you guys didn't argue even anything close enough to this to create a tribal issue of fact, and we didn't let you do this, and you lost, you know, your client a lot of money. Yeah. Any last thoughts before we move on to the last chunk of stories today?
Well, also interesting in this the 38-page memorandum and order that came out was the fact that she sort of ripped into the defense as well, and their tactics that they used.
Why don't you go into that a little bit, Dave?
So Charlie Nesson, who is a professor out of Harvard Law School, managed the defense along with a group of students from Harvard Law. And from the get-go of the case, when this thing went to trial, people had said that it was mismanaged, and people also said that he used a variety of tactics which were questionably unethical. For one, I remember, was when he made his opening arguments, he was suggesting to the jury that this is the law as it stands today, but the law is wrong, and that's usually a big no-no in opening statements because we call that jury nullification. You're trying to tell the jury that although the law says this right now, it's not correct, and it's up to you to make the decision on whether or not this constitutes infringement or not. You can't do that. It's not the decision of an attorney who is representing a party in the case to try to sway the jury based on the law. The law is the law. The judge is supposed to instruct the jury on how to apply the law, and then based on how that law is instructed to the jury is then supposed to decide on what the law is in the case and who is at fault. So that was one of the big problems. There was also a number of other blunders, including constant late filings and last-minute things that popped up, I think. So Judge Gertner, who is known as being a very, I don't want to say liberal, but...
Plaintiff-friendly judge.
Plaintiff-friendly judge, yeah, right.
Or defendant-friendly in the criminal context.
Right, she's pretty lenient, in, I guess you could say, when you compare her to certain other federal judges. The fact that she took the time to rip into their defense, I thought, was pretty interesting. And she basically was saying that it was mishandled and this was not the correct way to go about it. Possibly even you could go as far to say as, well, when Joel Tenenbaum was on the stand and he openly admitted to downloading the songs, and that's what eventually led to the plaintiffs filing the motion for directed verdict, which then ended the trial there on the spot. That could have been a mismanagement as well. Although you, as an attorney, you cannot instruct a material witness to lie on the stand or any witness to lie on the stand. So they couldn't have said, Joel, you can't, you know, if they ask you this, you have to say no. There probably could have been ways that, you know, he was basically prepped to handle certain types of questions without crossing ethical boundaries, but you know, it was kind of clear that that right there killed the case, and that didn't seem to be handled very well. And also, she did not like the fair use claims, as we've already covered here. Interestingly, Nesson came out later and said that he had to add those arguments because earlier in the case, the judge had dismissed all of the abuse of process claims that the defendants had made against the recording companies.
Okay. Any last thoughts before we move on, Dominic?
Nope. All set.
David?
I think we covered just about everything.
Okay. In that case, our last story, it's got two parts. There are a couple of things that recently cropped up in privacy law. The first of which was that Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, was asked about Google and privacy concerns, and essentially his response was, "I don't get what the big fuss is. As long as you're not doing illegal things, you don't have to worry about privacy online."
The quote was, "If you have something you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place."
Yeah, which I think totally misses the point, and really frustrates me as you know, even a person, let alone a lawyer or a privacy advocate, the fact that everything I do should be open to the public and the government should have free access to it because it's fine, because, you know, I'm not doing anything illegal. That's just, it's frustrating.
I am going to take the opposite position here and play devil's advocate a little bit. And I don't know if that's exactly what he was saying. I think he was saying that when you post things online, especially in social media, you have to be aware that a lot of these things are going to be, you know, that a lot of these things can be seen by the public at large, and you have to be prepared, even if you use security mechanisms over the content that you're posting, that someone is eventually going to see them, and it has the potential to get out, and everyone might see it.
I mean, I understand you're playing devil's advocate. I just don't buy that reading. The reading is essentially, the way it reads to me is the way a lot of, you know, conservative commentators phrase the issue. It's like, well, you know, if the person isn't testifying on stand, what's he hiding? Why doesn't, you know, if he's really innocent, why doesn't he just take the stand and testify in his own defense? If he's not testifying, clearly he must be lying and or guilty. And I, you know, that's a little different because there's the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. But still, it's the idea of somebody who has control of that much data saying you should only be worried about your data getting out if you're doing something wrong is worrisome, and made only more so by the fact that, you know, every bit of data I have in my life right now is backed up on Google somehow or another. Yeah,
sure.
Dominic?
Yeah,
it took it. Yeah.
Well, I guess it is disconcerting to hear the CEO of Google say that something like that, because it's taking the decision out of the user's hands and putting in the decisions of some third-party observer in saying, oh, well, you don't have anything to hide, so why are you worried? It's a misunderstanding of what privacy is and how it relates to, for lack of a better phrase, just human dignity in terms of, I mean, there's parts of your life that you keep to yourself. I mean, you don't broadcast everything that goes that you think about every day, and although some people, I guess, do on Twitter, but it's something that it relates to somewhat to the Fourth Amendment in some ways with privacy in that regard. And it's just disconcerting to hear it coming right from the very top of Google, that sort of, it's almost a fake argument, and because it doesn't feel like an effective one, that if you don't have anything to hide, why are you concerned about this? Because it's not about having anything to hide. It's about having the dignity as a human person to control what people can see or know about you. You have that control. No one else should have that control.
So. Yeah, I can appreciate that, but at the same time, it's your choice whether or not you want to go on to social media and start broadcasting information about yourself. And moreover, you have the ability to review privacy policies, which are posted on nearly every website these days. So you should know what the policies are of a particular website or a particular online service before you engage in, you know, actively participating in some sort of community.
Yeah, I have right. Two problems with that, though. First of all, Google is not social media, with the exception of, you know, Orkut.
Right, we're talking about search engine history, for example.
Yeah, we're talking about search engine history, email, Waves. We're talking about your calendars. We're talking about your to-do lists. We're talking about, you know, what widgets you have installed on your Google homepage. You know, this isn't pictures. I mean, so they have Picasa, too. I don't use Picasa, but we're not talking about, you know, status updates. We're not talking about, usually, pictures of parties. It's very worrisome for me that he would say that. To the best of my knowledge, he has not recanted that statement or retracted it anyway.
It's just a fundamental misunderstanding of what privacy is about. So,
right, and I'd like to add, as much as Cory Doctorow occasionally drives me up a wall, the scenarios that he's laid out in short stories, like I think it's Scroogle, Scroogle, and Little Brother are plausible enough that they're kind of terrifying. Wherein the government gets access to either the actual data from sites like Google and Facebook, or even metadata from that site. So, in Scroogled, the short story, the government managed to get access to not the access of the contents of your email, but the ads that are displayed in your email. And from that, they look at it, and you know, if you're being shown ads for, you know, model rocket engines, you know, the government, you know, when you're going across the border, stops you and says, so why are you getting ads for model rocket engines in your email? Are you building explosives? Why did you get an ad for this new book by John Stewart? Are you liberal? And it's the idea that, you know, I don't know if there's any privacy right in that metadata that Google has and what ads they show you. I don't think there is. If the government got a hold of that, it's really disturbing as to what, you know, what kind of targeting they could do with.
Well, conceivably, though, there are some laws that are already in place that govern government access to particular types of data, and certainly if you're the suspect in a criminal investigation, it's totally plausible that they could subpoena one of these companies, be it Google or whoever else, and get records of some of your data, though, right? Especially if they have a valid warrant as well.
Yeah, that's very plausible.
But that also seems to serve the same purpose of protecting one's privacy under the Fourth Amendment, though. I guess that's my point, is that those laws are enforced to protect our reasonable right to privacy, and there's a process in order to how the government can sort of, I guess, I don't really want to use this word, but circumvent, you know, the right to privacy in order to get at the data that might be protected.
Perhaps the most disturbing part is that, sure, even if you read all the privacy policies and are very careful about what you do, nothing prevents them from changing the privacy policies, and let alone the layout of the site itself, as seen in the other half of our story, which is the Facebook thing, where they change their privacy things, and Ben, I'll let you go from there.
Yes, so very recently, just this week, Facebook decided to basically totally redo its privacy settings. Some of the biggest changes are that, and this one's for the plus side, you can now get much more, you can drill down further with, you know, your privacy settings for individual posts as to who sees things like that. The downside is that now pretty much everything, the default is to be public to everybody. Where you used to be able to filter certain things by what networks you were a part of, like I'm part of the networks where I went to school, I'm part of the Boston network, where you used to be able to limit certain things to those networks, now you can't limit it, you know. Now if somebody searches for me, it's a lot easier to find me than it was before, because I used to just be findable to people on my network. That's no longer the case.
So I guess what's really concerning to me, though, is that, as you noted, Dominic, the privacy policies can change on particular websites. It's very much become sort of a take-it-or-leave-it proposition, where almost all of the privacy policies on certain websites are almost identical. So you've essentially got private legislation there, where every website seems to have similar privacy terms in terms of how they use your data or how they might be able to commercialize your data. And you can't escape those anywhere, because now they have sort of these policies that are function like contracts, and you have to agree to them in order to use the services, and everybody uses the services. And then if you want to use web-based mail, it's really hard to get away from those types of terms that you'd see in those privacy policy agreements.
The big disturbing thing with the Facebook thing is they've actually removed your ability to control some of the things that you could control before. Like, you used to be able to say, I don't want to show my profile picture to the whole world. I just want to show it to my friends. Now your profile public, your profile picture, whether you like it or not, is public to everyone. So too with pages that you're fans of. That used to be something that you could restrict. You could use privacy settings to restrict access to. And now your fan list of pages that you like is public. That's pretty staggering, considering that you can know a lot about a person, about their fan list, and perhaps some people don't want that sort of thing public, and now they might have had settings before where it was restricted, but now in just one fell swoop, Facebook has obliterated that.
Yeah, let's not forget, there's a program developed by somebody at MIT that could determine with some accuracy whether or not somebody was straight or gay based on who their friends were on Facebook, let alone, you know, what they're fans of. And I'm going to say what you're a fan of is a much better indicator of your preferences of things than who you're friends with.
Right. It's too bad because I felt that the privacy settings before the change were much more robust than they've made them. They've definitely taken away a lot of options to users in terms of how they can restrict access to certain areas of their Facebook pages. But my guess is the reason that they have done this is because Facebook might be becoming more of a maturing online service now, and they want people to stick around and continue using the service, and they want to be able to have people connect with new people all the time. So one way to do that is to, well, let's lighten up the privacy settings so therefore people can find each other more easily, make new connections, and hopefully go to the website more and continue to use our service so it doesn't, you know, over-mature itself and become a little bit obsolete because it's just used as like parked pages where you can somehow look up people every now and then versus making connections all the time.
What I find most disturbing about the way they did this change is you log into Facebook, it doesn't, unless you have read the stories about this change, it doesn't tell you that it's going to suddenly make everything default public. It just says, hey, we've got new recommended privacy settings. Just choose their recommendations and everything will be fine. It doesn't inform you about what's going on. And the default is accept our recommended settings. And you have to manually click, no, 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 keep my old settings for everything. It just feels like they're trying to, for lack of a better word, trick people into revealing more information than people might have done before. And people who aren't paying attention, who just assume that Facebook recommendations are what they should be doing, are just going to reveal a lot of information without necessarily knowing that they just did so.
Yeah. When I saw that pop up, I kept it on all of my old settings, but at some point I really have to go through and I've been using Facebook less and less over the past few years as they keep on finding new and interesting ways to violate my privacy, you know, going from beacon to, you know, ending here, or if not ending here, eventually arriving at this place. But I'm really at some point going to have to pare down what information I have on Facebook. I'm virtually a fan of nothing. I have very few applications just to keep my data from getting out.
Yep. I've done that for years, as a matter of fact. It's one reason I never accept any of those odd app requests that you get for like Mafia Wars or whatever, just because when you do that, you're, you know, allowing those applications to access your profile page and stuff, and, you know, that's always been a little disconcerting to me, and I certainly don't like certain areas of my life being broadcast over Facebook to everybody that's already within my small and restricted group of friends.
Yeah. I quit Facebook for a good year and a half for deleting all my friends, removing everything. Just after Beacon came out, I was just like, these people aren't going to respect privacy. And I'm sad to see that they keep going down that same direction, even though I put myself back on Facebook because everyone else was using it. They were like, hey, we want to invite you to our party, but you're not on Facebook. Like, you could send me an email. They're like, oh, but that's so much work.
Yeah, that's pretty much the only reason I use Facebook now.
Exactly.
To keep track of events that I'm inviting to, that I'm invited to, and events that I'm inviting people to.
So it just seems like they're in it. And the way they did this change is so, like, business as usual. Just click here, it'll be all right. And until I read the articles about this change, I didn't even know that they suddenly made fan pages public and they made your profile picture public. It's like, okay, I didn't see that. I'm a reasonably sophisticated internet user. I looked at the page pretty quickly and I didn't see anything on the page that said, oh, by the way, we've made this stuff public, so you should delete it if you don't want it public. Nothing like that was there. Like, I'm fine with it making changes like this, provided they inform people about them clearly. Legislatively, it might be interesting to see in the next 10 or 20 years whether there will be consumer protection laws about what websites must do in terms of informing people about changes in privacy settings or what sort of information they're going to reveal.
Yeah, or on the other hand, what it would take to get a legislative action to get, you know, a protection right. of what movies you get from that being disclosed. Somebody had to crucify a Supreme Court a nominee to the Supreme Court to get Congress to act on that. You know, how long is it going to be before, you know, the next justice of the Supreme Court was on Facebook and, you know, somebody pulls out a picture of them at a party?
From 25 years ago, and it's like, hey, look at this, or the Supreme Court justice was playing beer pong, guys.
Possibly, though, that's just another good reminder. I hate to reiterate Eric Schmidt's statement, but of if you don't want stuff to be public at any time in the future, don't put it on the internet.
That's not what he said. he said, if you don't have anything to hide, why are you worried? But basically, what you did say, although it's not a reiteration of his statement, is a good thing. Like, anything you put online, anything you do online, is going to be potentially public, made public. So be very aware that if you are worried about people finding about what you're doing online, tread very carefully. Either take precautions and realize that those precautions, such as using something like Tor, are not fail-safe. There are always ways. I mean, we live in a world that is primarily physical, and anything you do does impact bits and electrons, and people can notice those changes. So if they're looking, I mean, so there's no such thing as absolute security and absolute privacy. It's just a question of how much time and money people want to spend to break that particular security or privacy. You can do things to make it a big pain in the butt to break that security and privacy, but that's not a guarantee. And ultimately, if you don't feel secure about doing something, then you should seriously consider. I mean, it's a risk trade-off, basically. Most of the time, for most people, the risk trade-off is it's fine to do this. It's not going to hurt you. But in those situations where perhaps you're dealing with a startup that is in stealth phase and you want to provide a document to someone, it might be best to hand that off the old-fashioned way and not do something online where it could be. I mean, who knows, your email account gets hacked by someone if you're being watched by a larger company. You don't know these things. So being a little paranoid and taking those precautions can always help a long way.
That was a good wrap-up, Dominic. Any last thoughts before we close it out for the week? Dominic?
All set.
David?
Nope.
Thank you for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. We'd like to remind you to visit our website, www.technicallylegal.org, email us, podcast@technicallylegal.org, or visit us on the Twitters, @TechLegal. So, signing off, I'm Ben Snakehoff.
I'm Dominic Rabia.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.
One world, a man,
and
three
men,
one podcast.
That sounds terrible.